Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. As we enter our second century of podcast here on Research in Religion, and by that I don't mean that we are literally 100 years old, only that today's broadcast represents our 101st published interview, I thought I'd go off the beaten path a bit and bring up a topic that, well, I have no idea where it might lead. That topic is the internet. Our program, after all, was inspired and shaped by the dramatic reduction in the cost of technology and information distribution. 20 years ago, I would never have imagined that I could become my own radio host and broadcast my thoughts literally all around the world to thousands of listeners for what amounted to about $2,000 in startup costs and a couple hours per week of work. So what technology has brought us has been truly incredible and has a great deal of upside. Then again, it might just have some downside, as the internet and modern recording technology can be used to perpetrate all sorts of hoaxes and nefarious deeds. So what about this whole interwebs thingy? Is it a vehicle for us to improve our understanding of the world around us, or is it merely a place to play Peggle until all hours of the night when we should be working? To answer that question, and hopefully many others, I'm very excited to have on the show Jeremy Lott, who earned a religious studies degree at Trinity Western University and is the author of four books, including In Defense of Hypocrisy, Picking Sides in the War on Virtue, The Warm Bucket Brigade, The Story of the American Vice Presidency, I'll Never Forget It, Memoirs of a Political Accident from East Baltimore, and William F. Buckley, part of the Christian Encounters series from Thomas Nelson Press. He also has written hundreds, if not thousands, of articles from a variety of publications, including the Financial Times, The Guardian, and The American Prospect. But most important, at least for our present purposes, Jeremy is the editor of Real Clear Religion, a news portal and blogging site that provides a great deal of information on religion, stuff, and junk. To cite the founding manifesto of that site, quote, "Religion is serious and silly, scandalous and sublime. Religion writing ought to reflect this reality. Too often, it doesn't. That's a problem because religion is vitally important to billions of people the world over. It gives them a way to think about making sense of things, forming families, helping others, and helping themselves. RealClearReligion.org aims to change this. We want to improve religion writing by highlighting the best of it, by giving interesting parties a daily short list of news and commentary that they really ought to check out. We will cover religion in itself and religion as it influences those things that we can't avoid. Religion and science, religion and culture, religion and commerce, religion and politics." Unquote. We will post links to all of Jeremy's books as well as the Real Clear Religion site, which has us on its blog roll. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. I should also note that Jeremy lives in the podunk town of Linden, Washington, which I happen to know because it is just north of the podunk town of Duval, Washington, where I live, and I've had the chance to drive through it many of times on my way up to Canada, eh? Jeremy, welcome to Research on Religion. You're in the big leagues now.
Oh, it's so exciting.
Very, very cool. You're actually going to reach some Canadian listeners too, because we have some folks that listen up in, I think, Moose Jaw, Canada. So we're very proud of those listeners.
Have you ever been to Concrete, Washington?
I think I've driven through that once on the way to going camping one time. Yeah.
No, it's so these little Washington towns are a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I love them. That's great too, because Linden is fun. It's got a lot of character to it. There's kind of the Dutch influence that's there and all that kind of thing. So everybody around the world should stop by and visit Linden, Washington. So,
yeah, but make sure not to do it early in spring when they're fertilizing the field.
Okay, very cool. Hey, all right. Before getting to all the spiritual stuff, let's let's start off talking about this whole Real Clear thing, because it's become a big phenomena on the interwebs and is one of the major news portals that many people use around here. Now, you're the editor of Real Clear Religion, Real Clear Science, and I believe also Real Clear Books. And I'm sure the combination of Real Clear Religion and Real Clear Science probably makes Richard Dawkins' head explode. But all of those sites are part of a larger, more nefarious umbrella organization known as the Real Clear Network. And I think that's operated by Dr. No from some underwater volcano in the South Pacific. Am I correct there?
We're not allowed to divulge the location of our headquarters.
Ah, okay. yeah, that's why.
But our cover story is that we operate out of Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what is this Real Clear Network, and when did this thing all start?
The Real Clear Politics was the first site. It launched in 2000. And then it was bought by, Forbes bought a 51% stake in it in 2007. We've launched, there's I think now 11 Real Clears. The second one was Real Clear Markets, and then you had Sports and World, and then Science and Religion came along. And last year we launched Real Clear History and Real Clear Books, and this year we launched Real Clear Policy, which I also have a hand in.
Oh, Real Clear Policy. How does Real Clear Policy differ from Really Clear Politics?
They're more interested in horse race stuff. The Real Clear Policy is far more boring.
Mm. So you like pick apart the health bill. Did you have to, as editor of Real Clear Policy, did you have to read the entire Obamacare bill, all 3,700 pages?
Well, thank God I have a great co-editor who's, much more, named Joseph Lawler, who's much more comfortable reading through the entire healthcare bill than I am.
Okay. All right. Just, that's cool. So as you mentioned, there's Real Clear Markets, there's Real Clear Books, Real Clear Sports. Any other octopus tentacles you guys got out there?
We got Real Clear Technology, Real Clear Energy. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out, and I guess I'll just have to apologize for that. There's a lot of us. I think we should just launch Real Clear Everything and call it a day.
Yeah, there you go. Well, what's the beginning title all about, Real Clear? Why, do you know anything about the founders, why they chose Real Clear? Or is this the name they were drunk one night and threw some darts at a dartboard and came up with it?
Yeah, what they said was that they thought that basically there wasn't a good site that was pulling together a lot of information about politics, not just from one point of view, but from all points of view. They thought also that there's just too much noise and too much information out there for most people to make sense of it.
Right.
And so it would be very helpful to people if you had what is called intelligent aggregation, which is, you know, we read through just tons of stuff and try to winnow out the bad stuff and give you the best of it in a digestible format every day, kind of a bird's eye view of politics, of sports, of religion, of books, that sort of thing.
Intelligent aggregation. That sounds a little bit like Skynet. So you guys moving to the Terminator website soon or anything?
We haven't talked about sci-fi just yet.
Okay. How did you get involved in this? You weren't initially involved in the founding, but no. You kind of came along later. Tell us that story.
In 2008, they considered hiring me for politics, but it didn't prove a good fit. And the founders are named John McIntyre and Tom Bevan. And John McIntyre, he said, you know, I don't think this is going to work, but we want to hire you. And you know, you have an interest in religion, and so why don't you get back to me at some point, and we'll talk about doing that. So we launched Real Clear Religion in October of 2010, and along with Real Clear Science.
So why, let me ask you this, they said, yeah, this is not going to be a good fit for this. Why? What do they mean by that? I mean, can't anybody just intelligently aggregate stuff? Or
no, it wasn't that. It was just, it had to do with timing, and they just said, look, you're more interested in religion anyway, so why don't we have you, concentrate on that when we hire you?
So it launches in 2010, Real Clear Religion and Real Clear Science. Now, when they were initially talking to you about this, you said, hey, I'm really interested in religion. Why don't you let me go ahead and do Real Clear Science? And they throw the evolution book at you or something. How'd you get those two assignments? I mean, a religion you're interested in, but what about science?
Yeah, the science thing, it was I was paying for my many sins on that one.
Mm-hmm.
In order to pay my way through college, a couple of summers, I worked for Washington State University in our satellite research station up in Lyndon, Washington. And we did entomological and horticultural research. Uh-huh. And I was a grunt one year and then managed the station the next. And so John then saw that I had a background in science and said, well, when we were launching these, you know, we're going to need a backup for science and a backup for religion. And Alex Berezow, who's the editor of Real Clear Science, is, you know, I think he's a Presbyterian. And why don't we guys have you back each other up and help each other out? And I said, okay. And that's how that worked out.
Yeah. So you have that background in horticulture. So is Real Clear Science just all about like horse manure and stuff like that?
Alex is really the driving force behind Real Clear Science, and he's has a degree in biology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just very interested in how science touches our everyday life. And he's the geek's geek, and he's just really, really good at what he does.
And it shows, too, because I listen to a lot of talk radio here in the Pacific Northwest and now with the technology all around the country. And it actually does get cited a lot. Real Clear Science is one that is picked up a lot by some of our local radio hosts who oftentimes call you up and interview on the air, too, about some of this stuff. So it's pretty neat. What about Real Clear Religion when, you know, you're talking about this in 2008, 2009, was it a hard sell to make to those guys from Real Clear Politics? Or saying, I don't know if the Real Clear Religion will sell or anything, or were they gung-ho about getting into it?
I had to convince them that there was an audience for this and that there was enough material to aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't too hard because I could point to a lot of religious websites and coverage and, you know, religion. They want to aggregate the best case scenario is you aggregate on things that people really care about, and people seem to really care about religion. And so that wasn't too hard to sell.
So, well, you said you had to convince them a little bit. Were they part of this, you know, East Coast, West Coast elite that says religion, that's going away, isn't it? Didn't you read?
Oh, no, they're part of the Midwestern elite, you know, they're in Chicago.
Well, Chicago's like Boston or, you know, L.A. That's not.
Tell that to someone from Chicago.
Okay. Well, yeah, I get it. I grew up just north of there in Milwaukee. So, you know, we always thought of, you know, the Chicago as that kind of the big, big, huge city, you know, yellow brick road kind of thing. You go there and, yeah. Anyways.
No, and if there's any consensus about what Real Clear is about, mm-hmm. as we say, we're not conventional wisdom and we're not PC.
Okay.
And so, to the extent that we have any sort of an organizing ideology, there it is.
Okay. So,
it's a lot easier to sell people with that sort of a negative ideology on, hey, we should cover religion.
Okay. And so you're not PC. Now, I don't think that means personal computer. Only people with Macs can use it. You mean politically correct, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Just making sure there. Hey, you mentioned that you worked a little bit with Wazoo, but I want to take you back to your school days of yore. You actually got a degree at Trinity Western University, which is, by the way, a private religious school in Canada. And so I got to ask, you grew up in California. So, dude, what were you thinking? A religious studies degree in Canada? I mean, seriously? What's that about?
Actually, I grew up in Washington.
Okay.
I was born in California, but don't tell too many people that.
Okay.
I don't know. It was a church, it was a college that a bunch of people I knew were going to, and when I went there, they were going to have a radio station, and I thought it'd be kind of fun to coast out my college years being sort of a late night host of a college radio station. And then the minute I got there, they decided to cancel the radio station. And so I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be a communications major anymore.
I guess that's a sign from God coming from a religious university. So,
and the only way I could salvage my credits at the time was to switch to a religious studies major. My dad asked me, you know, why are you doing this? And I said, well, I just figured, what the hell?
Yeah, what the hell, I guess. Was it just to salvage credits, or are you a religious guy? Do you have some kind of religious upbringing?
Yeah, my dad, I was raised a Baptist. My dad is a Baptist minister. And in 2004, I entered the Church of Rome.
Ah, you became a Catholic.
Yes.
All right. I got to do a show on that because I've interviewed a number of guests who have previously been Protestants that have been converting back to Catholicism. So I think you might be the fourth guest in that respect. And so I'm starting to see a trend line here. So I got to look into that a little bit. So you got this religious studies degree at Trinity Western University. Graduation is rapidly approaching. Do you have any plans on what you're going to do?
Well, the night job, in addition to the summer work, was really just to do a lot of freelance writing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two different ways of models of writing, basically. There's the academic model where you pay a lot of money and write something for one or two or three or four or a very small number of people. they criticize it and tell you what you did wrong and give it back to you with red marks on it.
Yeah. Or, and you got to be careful with that, because I've had some of my paper written by, read by up to 7 people.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Or, you know, you do something for a broad audience, you get paid for it, the editor thanks you and sends you a check.
Yeah.
And as I came to the close of school, I thought, well, you know, maybe that would be preferable.
Yeah. The payment thing is really cool.
And then Reason Magazine, I'd been doing some freelancing for me, and they'd really been bothering me about applying for an internship down in L.A. And I said, all right, fine. So I did the papers, and I got an internship there. This would be in, I think, 2002. And that I found out that summer while I was down there doing the internship that I graduated. Because it's a bad idea to do your own credit evaluation. Never do that.
No. You didn't think you had graduated yet, but you already...
No, I didn't think I'd graduated yet, but I had a few suspicions that I was close, maybe closer than I thought. So I called the registrar, who was a friend of mine, and I said, hey, Larry, would you do me a favor and do a credit eval on me because I think I screwed something up? And he called me back and he says, well, you should have walked because you were 2 classes out. But when we transferred your community college classes in, we did a bad job, and we could have counted this thing in this category and this thing in that category. So where do I send the diploma? And so then I'm down there doing my internship in L.A., not sure where the heck I'm going to, you know, I just came out of left field. And so then I cast about and ended up working for a crazy Canadian magazine for a bit, and then got a call from D.C. and went to work for the American Spectator and kind of bounced around D.C. for 7 years.
Okay. And then you made it home back to Lyndon, Washington, right?
Oh, thank God.
Now, you like Lyndon, Washington better than Fairfax?
It's a lot better.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree with that, too. I'm a small-town kind of guy, so I'm with you there. So, okay, you're bouncing around doing this, you know, writing thing, American Spectator. You made a stop at Cato, too, for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked at the Cato Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I was a blogger for Get Religion for a while as well.
Oh, what's that? What's Get Religion?
Get Religion is a journalism criticism website.
Okay.
That looks at how the press covers religion.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously that, you know, puts you in that realm of the Real Clear Religion universe here that you could be doing that. But, hey, did you pull anything from your religious studies at Trinity? I'm always kind of curious of, you know, what us academics actually convey to our students. Obviously, we only write for 3 or 4 people, as you reminded me. But was there anything that you pulled out of Trinity Western University and you said, wow, this is really interesting kind of stuff, and I'm going to pursue that kind of line of thinking in my writing?
Yeah, I mean, there is a remarkable things that I pulled out of Trinity. They're the home of the Dead Sea Scrolls Institute, among other things. I did a big, when it still existed, I did a big feature piece about it for Lingua Franca. I basically started, I started in religious journalism from the things that I observed there or even covering things that went on there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very, very useful to me. And then they also have a Catholic adjunct school called Redeemer Pacific, and I took some courses there, and that also helps me to eventually put me on the road to Rome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So reading that Catholic stuff, I guess. Yeah, that's how some of our other folks have kind of gotten back into that. Now, one of the things that I have to note, both on the Real Clear Religion and Real Clear Politics site, is, and it's noted on the Wikipedia page, is that you've argued that there's been a bias against religious folks in the media, specifically by Christians, and I'm talking here about the traditional media. Do you, given what you've experienced over the past decade, writing in a lot of different forums and observing this stuff a lot closer than I do you really think that that is the case, that there is a bias among the traditional media toward religion or the way that they cover religion?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit ignorant. I mean, that has a lot to do with it. Just the number of stupid things that you see in the New York Times about religion, for instance, that don't get caught by fact checkers or copy editors, it's kind of astounding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the former editor of the Times, Bill Keller, writing in a column, and he called Rick Santorum an evangelical, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Well, evangelical Catholic.
No, he originally called him an evangelical.
Just the evangelical, because they all look alike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, the liturgy is exactly like an evangelical service.
Well, actually, I think it's the sweater vest. Because ever since evangelicals got away from that polyester in the 90s, it's all been sweater vests, I guess. I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing to me that, the Washington Post launches a website on faith that covers religious stuff. And one of the co-editors is Sally Quinn, and I have no bias against atheists or anything, but she's an atheist who just didn't have much knowledge coming into this and just thought it'd be fun. I think that their product has gotten steadily better, but it created some serious problems early on.
Now, you said early on there were some problems, but you just mentioned that it's gotten steadily better. Do you think that sites like yours, the Real Clear Religion or even Real Clear Politics, has had an influence on the traditional media that they have to really fact check their work a little bit more, lest they get caught by one of these sites saying, hey, you guys didn't really back up what you're saying there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're the new gatekeepers, and they need clicks, and if we don't give them to them, they don't get them in the numbers that they need a lot of times. So there's that, and there's also that we'll link to their critics a lot. If they've done a bad job and people call them out, a lot more people will find out about it now than they used to.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a really superb way that you do that. Now, on our site, Real Clear Religion, you still link to some of these news sources, the Washington Post and the New York Times, right?
Yep. Yeah, we link to them a lot. If they do good stuff, we link to it. Or if they do bad stuff, we link to it and link to the critics at the same time.
So, do you have any other examples of some of this mainstream media bias toward religion?
Yeah, I mean, I, for instance, I won't say which job it was, but one of the jobs I interviewed for over the years, I mean, I literally had, for an entirely secular outlet, I had an editor asking me if I believed in the virgin birth. Just the sort of, there's this idea that Christians are just kind of weird.
Yeah.
And you see it over and over again in how they're covered, you know, famously the Washington Post said that, you know, evangelicals were, you know, less literate and uneducated and whatnot. And so then this was in the time of fax machines. And so they got spammed with faxes by people faxing them their graduate degrees.
mean,
you know, hey, I'm an evangelical and I have an advanced degree. And they, you know, and it's just not true. They've done a lot of, polling of this. And in fact, people who are more affluent tend to go to church more often than people who don't have as much money, for instance.
Yeah, and I, one of the things I'm always astounded by, and this includes surveys of academics, is that people who are non-religious often tend to have a higher propensity to believe in things like UFOs and Bigfoot and ghosts and homeopathic remedies for medicines and things like that. They accuse religious folks of not being very scientific, but then they're, you know, off to their herbal medicine person or something.
Well, I think they just think we have the wrong aura.
Okay. Okay. I guess our biorhythms are out of sync, I think. So Real Clear Religion is devoted to not only this intelligent aggregation, as you talked about before, but kind of as a way to remedy the bias by bringing a lot of different voices to a single place. And I'm kind of interested on how you do that. I'm one of the things I do on this podcast is really talk to people who are practitioners on a regular basis and ask them about the nuts and bolts of their job. You know, you're a priest. What does it mean to be a priest? What do you do on a daily basis? So I want to ask you that kind of nuts and bolts stuff right now. What does your average day look like as the intelligent aggregator for Real Clear Politics?
First of all, I never sleep, but,
no sleep.
Other than that. Yeah. I mean, we do a lot of, we update twice a day for Real Clear Religion. I have some help now. I have a great deputy editor named Nicholas Hahn.
Now, is he in Linden, too, or is he
out? No, he's in Chicago.
Okay.
And he does a lot of the day-to-day updating, but we do a lot of working together, and, I'm telling him, link to this, change this headline, that sort of thing. I do some of the updates myself, but usually whenever I do an update, I call him and run it by him, and half the time he does that for me. And just because we want to have a diversity of views, we want to make sure that we're hitting certain religions get, I mean, for instance, early on, it was really important to us that we link to a lot of Mormon pieces. And so we went and looked for good Mormon stuff. And one of the things you learn as you do this for a while is after a while, the stuff starts coming to you. People start sending you links, and it gets more more interesting, and there's a lot more voices that go into the product than just the original people that were running it.
Indeed, that is true, because I actually sent you a link saying, hey, you should check out this Research on Religion site. It's a podcast series, and you were kind enough to put it up on your blog roll, so that's a very cool thing.
Happy to do that.
Your guest editor, too, or your co-editor, he's out in Chicago, so he's got a two-hour time jump advantage of you. Now, you say you don't sleep. I get up in the morning, I go on to the Real Clear site, and I check. You got your morning update. It's up there pretty early. So you got a morning update and an afternoon update. When do these things come out?
Well, Washington State time, it doesn't matter when the site goes up in the morning, just as long as it's up by 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it can go up the night before. That's happened a few times, let's just say.
Okay.
But then the later update comes, we put that together and get it out there by 11:30. So that's 1:30 Chicago time.
And 2:30 on the East Coast. So 6:30 Washington time, you want to have the morning update. So that's 9:30-ish in New York City.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And this is, I mean, we just talked New York City and Chicago here. This site, I'm sure, gets heard around the world. So, you know, we're talking London time, Tokyo time. I'm sure you track, you know, where your sources are coming from. You get a lot of people from different places?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things is that I'm a bit of an Anglophile, and so I've linked to a lot of British sources. And, mm-hmm. you know, surprise, surprise, a lot of Brits read us regularly. So that's a big source of readers. We get some stuff from over in bits of Asia, that sort of thing. But primarily we're after an American audience than anyone else who wants to read.
So each of these updates, the morning update and the afternoon update, basically you highlight, I don't know, about a half dozen to a dozen or so interesting links. How do you actually determine which ones to highlight? Are there certain ones that you always go back to, or you know, is it, how do you find this stuff?
I mean, there's certain websites that do a pretty good job either reporting or representing certain viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you go back to those regularly. You know, we're always checking, you know, Christianity Today, the Christian Post, Jewish Ideas Daily, the Jewish Daily Forward, the Deseret News, things like this.
Do you have one? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And, you know, CNN has a pretty good belief blog, and there are certain regulars. But then we're always looking for other stuff that, you know, we might have missed. Honestly, I've got a ton of friends on Facebook, and they're always posting religious stuff, and I'm always scrolling through my newsfeed and seeing if there's stuff that we've missed.
Yeah, no, that's a kind of a neat way of doing it. You let a lot of other people kind of sniff out the sites to you and, you know, bring their own little bits and pieces of information that are coming to you. Do you use one of those, what do they call them? I don't know the technology too well, like spider crawlers, where you plug in a certain keywords and you have it just automatically search on the internet and bring back stuff?
I mean, I occasionally use the Google, but no, I tend to roll it all myself in terms of looking. I don't know what Nick does. I think he tends to also be pretty old-fashioned in terms of going after stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I got to ask, this is the critical question here. Why doesn't Research on Religion get a prominent mention every Monday morning when we first air? I mean, and I'm one of your Facebook friends, man, you know?
All right. We'll have to look into that and see what we can do.
All right. Because, you know, we got all those academics. And, you know, the part of this whole thing is to get, and you were correct earlier on. I know it was kind of a little bit of a facetious tongue-in-cheek remark that academics only get read by four or five other people. But, you know, it's not too far off, because I think the typical academic journal article gets cited a modal amount of times as zero. You write something and it's just off into the netherworld. And one of the things that we've been trying to do is bring up some of this interesting research to a broader audience, and forcing a number of our academic guests on the show to actually speak to a broad audience. You consider that the audience is actually very intelligent, but to get away from the jargon, high priest, ivory tower kind of stuff. So you know, hey, we gotta get this
academics do very valuable work. It would be nice if people knew about it.
Yeah, no, that's what we're doing here. So, hey, anyways, I mentioned Wikipedia a while back, and I want to get your take on that site, because this is one of the things that has come up with the era of blogging that exploded about a decade or so ago. And Wikipedia is, you know, kind of what Real Clear Religion does. It brings in a lot of different voices. It creates intelligent aggregation, but compiles it in one area. And so I want to set the discussion a little bit for you to maybe react to, because I have this discussion with students and a number of my colleagues all the time. You know, Wikipedia does tend to have a very bad reputation among academics. And I, you know, as I mentioned, I talk to my colleagues about this, and, you know, I walk amongst these creatures, and you constantly hear these disparaging comments about how unreliable that site is and how students shouldn't be using it. And the dirty little secret, though, is that a lot of faculty members that do disparage it in their classes, even at some of the most prominent universities, are using it quite frequently because, well, it provides a lot of really good information quickly at your fingertips. And, you know, I have a bit of theory of why that is, or why academics tend to disparage it. But I want to get your impressions first. Have you any thought about why academics and other intellectual elite pundits tend not to like the Wikipedias of the world?
I mean, Wikipedia, I'll theorize here and say that one of the reasons, a couple of the reasons they wouldn't like it is that, you know, it's by a bunch of amateurs, they're all volunteers, there is a hierarchy that among Wikipedians, but it's self-created, it's not at all credentialed, and so a lot of academics are going to distrust that. There have been some studies where they looked at your average Wikipedia entry versus your average Encyclopedia Britannica entry, and they found out when they did these studies a couple years ago that Wikipedia was slightly less reliable, but the difference is you could actually fix the Wikipedia entry.
Yes, yes.
You know, and I have mixed feelings about Wikipedia. It's, you know, if you look at the Real Clear Politics page, for instance, they don't even have some of the latest stuff updated. They don't have Real Clear books there. You know, a lot of it lags if you don't have people who are really interested.
Yeah, yeah, that's
true. Or, you know, I have a Wikipedia page, and, you know, a friend of mine managed to batten down the doors of the editors there and come up with enough links to make it work. But the sort of some of the standards of what they will or will not admit for evidence seem kind of weird to me. But, you know, look, they put together a product that's very useful to a lot of people. You know, and I don't believe that in just sort of snobbily dismissing that sort of thing.
Now, did you write your own Wikipedia page?
Or I had almost nothing to do with it other than a friend said, I want to do a Wikipedia page. Where do I go to find stuff out about you? And I sent her dozens of links, you know, okay, you know, have fun with this if you want to.
Yeah, that happened to me as well. So I had a former student contact me a couple years back and says, hi, you got a Wikipedia page right now. I created one for you. And I'm like, oh. And it was accurate as far as it goes, because it was just taking stuff off my regular faculty website at the University of Washington. So, but I think you put your finger on some of what academics think about Wikipedia, in that it is this non-controlled environment of people. You don't know who they are writing on stuff, and you tend to get a little bit froggy about, you know, what they might actually write about. But more importantly, I think it takes away a lot of our authority, because it's people like me, the PhD types, who get to write in Encyclopedia Britannica. And as I oftentimes talk to my students about Wikipedia versus Encyclopedia Britannica, I ask them, well, what happens with Encyclopedia Britannica? Who's writing that? And how do you know that they are the authoritative source on this kind of thing? Because, you know, just because they have PhD at the back of their name doesn't mean that they're the exact expert or specialist on it. In fact, you could get, you know, some person who's a real big Civil War history buff and spends all his time tromping around Gettysburg and Antietam, looking at stuff and digging through museums just because he loves it, has a lot more knowledge than your average scholar who might study Civil War history or that era. So I think it in many ways it becomes a big threat to the intellectual elite. And as you're saying too, Wikipedia has that neat feature that information constantly comes at it and can be checked and balanced and by a lot of different people. Now, it doesn't happen all the time because people just, you know, don't come to the pages and it deteriorates after a while, or somebody slips something in and you don't catch it right away. But it has that feature of doing that. And I think also that's what real clear religion, real clear politics, real clear science and books tends to do. You bring a lot of different voices to the forum and you say, hey, you folks out there, we trust you. You read this stuff and figure it out yourself. You don't have to rely upon the expert. I mean, is that your feelings on things, or?
Yeah, I mean, look, credentials are matter only insofar as that they teach you things.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing is information, and information, it doesn't need a PhD attached to it.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Actually, I'm thinking back now that we hit our 100th episode here, I'm going to be on Facebook shortly and putting up a list of my top 10 favorite interviews. And actually, to reveal my hand here a little bit, one of the most favorite interviews I did was with an independent scholar who was really interested in hymns. And he did all this independent work himself. He gathered up these hymnals and he counted the number of times certain songs appeared and tracked this over the span of 200 years and noticed that Amazing Grace wasn't in that list of the most popular American hymns for the past 2-3 centuries. And, you know, he started digging into why that is. And he came up with a really, really great answer I would have never have thought of. And, you know, he's just some guy that did this. And the amount of knowledge that he brought to the table, I thought was just absolutely spectacular. And that's, again, what you're doing. I mean, you're doing this source where you just, hey, here's a lot of really interesting stuff and people should do this. So, now, but here, I still got to ask this question because this does get back to the Wikipedia thing. Every day you toss a bunch of articles up from around the interwebs. And how do you determine whether this is good quality stuff or some garbage from some cranky old grandmother in her pajamas who's sitting in Cedro Woolley making stuff up? Do you have some kind of filter, or do you read all this stuff, by the way, too?
Yeah, we read. I won't say we've read every word of every article that we've ever linked to, but, mm-hmm. you know, we read the articles and, you know, just use our best judgment.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gets better over time. You learn things. And I have a lot of experience that I brought to the table, and Nick did and is learning. And, you know, you do your very best to link to the very best, and that's all you can do.
Now, we were talking about the quality of traditional media or mainstream media before in terms of their religious reporting. Has there ever been a time where, you know, New York Times comes out with something and you go, this doesn't look quite right. Should we put it up or should we not put it up? Have you ever thought about doing that to some extent?
Yeah, there have been times we didn't post it, or that a lot of times if something I see as being seriously flawed, I hold it back and I wait until the criticisms of that come out, and then I will link to that along with its critics.
All right. So here, you know, you've been at this for, let's see, hired in 2010 to launch Real Clear Religion. So you've been at this for about 2 years now. Lots of information streams going through you. You say you never sleep. So you're reading all this stuff. Let's just get to the substance of what you've been finding out. What have you learned about America's religious landscape, or religion in general, for that matter? Has your role as an editor of Real Clear Religion changed your views on anything?
This year we had to do all the Real Clears did a state of series. So the state of sports, the state of world affairs, the state of markets, the state of politics, the state of religion. I had to write the religion piece, and I then had to dig into a lot of the polling that's been done on religion over the past 60 years or so. And, it was very eye opening because there are certain narratives that you see in the press. You know, people, this is a less Protestant nation. This is, there are way more atheists than there used to be. You know, the faith is on the decline. And the numbers just don't really back that picture up very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, American religion is, I would describe the state of a religion in America as being robust but confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people just keep going to church here and really much and identifying as religious in much higher numbers than people expected that they would, and it just confounds the experts.
Yeah, you just brought up something that was kind of sticks in my craw a little bit. A couple years ago, when I was contemplating doing a podcast series like this. And I got called up by Georgine Rice, who runs a radio show out of Portland, to actually host, guest host some of her shows when she was away on vacation. One of the big issues came up was the kind of a state of American religion, and a survey had just been released. I think it was the American Religion Identification Survey that identified a dramatic increase in the number of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not of Catholic nuns, but of people who didn't have any religious affiliation that they stated in an interview. Now, it didn't mean that they didn't believe in God or that they were atheists, but just that when you asked them, are you religious? And you're like, eh, not really. So that would count as nuns. And I remember a number of the call-in folks from that show and you know, Georgine Rice herself were about to jump off the ledge and say, oh my gosh, this is the end of Christian civilization in the United States as we know it. I'm like, no. First of all, you know, just kind of look at the numbers and you can see it's, you know, even though it might seem like a big jump, it's still a very, very small slice of the world. But one of the other things I noticed with that survey just drove me absolutely crazy. They purported having a huge sample size, something like 60,000 people interviewed. And people go, wow, you interviewed 60,000 people. That's amazing. But if you look close into the data, they had the United Church of Christ, who are the Congregationalists, the old Puritans, had between, I think when they did the surveys, and it was 1990, roughly 2000, and again in 2006 or somewhere in that respect, they had the size of the United Church of Christ tripling in size between for about 5 years in the 1990s, and then losing about half their members. And I said, if the United Church of Christ tripled in size in a matter of, you know, 8-9 years in the 1990s, that would have been—
Miracles really are still happening.
Yeah, that would have been major news. I mean, that's so— I kind of been very suspicious of that survey. And it's funny how, in many ways, and maybe you could speak to this because you look at this stuff every day, how certain stories or certain tropes tend to get repeated in the media quite a bit. Do you see that at all?
Yeah, you do. I mean, especially with what we're talking about here. I mean, the one of the problems is that people a lot of times will view religious stories through the eyes of politics,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And if you're from the left, you have this sort of progressive idea or ideal, and a lot of times you're going to use that as the lens through which you view religion. It's either this antiquated thing that needs to wither away, or it needs to evolve and get better and more tolerant and all this other stuff. And you know, those are nice little aspirations, I guess. But people then tend to see what they want to see when they look at these surveys, and they try to see their progressive ideal coming about. And a lot of times that just isn't how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is odd. And you, again, since you go through these media sources and you sift through them, which I appreciate that effort a great deal, because again, I get up in the morning and say, hey, just go to Real Clear Religion and check out what's up there. I'll let Jeremy do the work for me. You still see these constant tropes or stories that are repeated. And I, you know, think of the old term gravitas that came out during the 2000 election. You know, one person used the word gravitas, and I'd never heard the term gravitas before. And then all of a sudden, you know, every newscaster on every news station was gravitas, gravitas, gravitas. And you see, I mean, that was just one clear example of a very strange word that sticks out in my mind. But you know, that must be happening in more subtle ways across the span of the media too.
Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of that, and one of the constant fights that I have with Real Clear Religion is to try to keep it, you know, this is a religion website that also does politics, because there's a political component of religion, but we want to encourage people to cover religion in itself and not to always try to see their politics in religion.
No, absolutely. It's a lot of that I focus on religion and politics, and so do many of my colleagues. We oftentimes forget that, you know, people like religion for religion's sake, not necessarily for politics. But, you know, a lot of media sources like the conflict and the drama that goes into it, sells newspapers. So the politics angles comes up quite a bit. Have you noticed any trends in reporting over the past 2 years? Have certain stories tended to emerge and then disappear?
Well, if I ever see another headline if I never see another headline with the title "The Mormon Moment" in it, I will breathe a huge sigh of relief.
Yeah, the Mormon Moments has been lasting for about 6 years now, hasn't it?
Good Lord. Yeah, I mean, I don't, one of the things that you're going to see a lot more of this year, for obvious reasons, is that Mormons are going to become a much bigger story.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Mormons is we seem to, you know, forget every generation about what we learned about them in the last generation.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. And they're very sensitive to that fact. I have a number of very good friends at BYU, and, you know, they're excited that Mitt Romney is the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. And they're like, yes, finally we can start talking about some of the stuff that everybody's been ignoring for the last 10 years. And I'm like, yeah, you know, so I can kind of understand that. And any other trends or things that in the media that you see that annoy you or maybe even give you hope or something?
Yeah, hope is always interesting.
Mm.
No, I you're seeing a lot of these stories now about how you have these post-political evangelicals.
Yes.
I don't, you know, first of all, evangelicals were never that political.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I mean, they had to be dragged kicking and screaming into politics, basically. At the end of the 1970s. So I think that's a little bit absurd, but also, you know, their voting patterns haven't significantly changed. I think it's a little bit silly, and we're going to see a little bit more of that silliness this being an election year.
Yeah, no, I'm seeing that as well, too, and hearing a lot of stuff about the millennial evangelicals. The kids who are coming through are disenchanted with the way that things were done before. And yeah, so
I guess one of the breakthroughs you're probably going to see this year is that, unfortunately, we're doing politics again, but evangelicals are all of a sudden going to find ways of voting for a Mormon.
And there's going to be a lot of news stories about that because, you know, during the primary season, there was a lot of news stories on why evangelicals were not going to vote for a Mormon. And then they ended up doing that. And here we are. So I got to ask you, you know, you've had the site up running for 2 years and it is a popular site. You get a lot of traffic coming to you. You've been cited on a number of different media sources. So definitely getting a lot of attention. Do you get a lot of hate mail coming at you?
We get a little bit here and there, but it's a surprisingly small amount of hate mail.
Oh, okay.
One of the things I really appreciate is when people write to us and just tell us you got something wrong. Now, if we did or if we didn't, that's not relevant to this, except that, I go see, you know, did we get this wrong? And if we did, let's fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is kind of a neat feeling. I thought you'd get a lot more criticism than you normally did. In fact, actually, you were the subject of criticism of one major media figure. I think Rush Limbaugh called you a name or something, didn't he?
Oh, he was just getting me back. Rush Limbaugh, he called me repeatedly on the air. He called me a liberal when he was reading from an article that I wrote for Politico.
Mm-hmm.
And my father then got, I'd say, half a dozen phone calls saying, Rush is reading from your son's thing on the air and calling him a liberal. You got to set him straight.
You know, I would have said, hey, let him keep reading because the amount of traffic driven your way for that, I mean, that would be amazing. I wish somebody would criticize me like that.
He was just mad at me about a piece I'd written about him in The Guardian at one point, I think.
Okay. Now, so that's pretty cool. So this is kind of your life right now. You're doing this blogging thing. You're aggregating. You're being an intelligent aggregator and that, and you're also doing some freelancing on the side. What kind of reflections on that? Has this been a really fulfilling career aspiration that you have? You're still pretty young and you love doing this. You get to continue doing this or?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great things about, I'm not one of these people who has great plans, except in very broad strokes. When I started writing, I never would have said, hey, I want to be an intelligent aggregator when I grow up, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what. Yeah,
but you know, it's a great job. I love it. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but it's good work. It's rewarding. It lets me be anywhere I want to be. And, I have an awful lot of influence for what I do. And it's a good life.
Yeah, no, it does seem. And you can kind of determine where you want to live. I mean, the fact that you do get to live in Linden, I kind of put tongue in cheek that it is a podunk town. I guess it still is. But, you know, I love that kind of living out in the middle of nowhere and still be able to have that reach from, you know, London to Linden and everywhere in between and have a lot of influence on that. So that absolutely is very cool. Do you have any, you know, you've written 4 books now. Do you have any other books that you have in mind that are rolling around in the cranium up there that you want to get out?
There's a book that I've been delaying for a couple of years that I hope to get done this year. It'll be about death, and it'll be about C.S. Lewis.
Oh. C.S. Lewis is dead, by the way. C.S. Lewis is dead, by the way.
Yes.
So that works out perfect.
He died on the same day as John F. Kennedy.
Okay. There you go. And you've been to the Grassy Knoll, have you not?
Yes, I've been to the Grassy Knoll. They had a big sign.
Yes, and on your Facebook page, that is one of the pictures that you have up there, which is I really think, because again, one of the things that I like reading all your posts and that is you have a really good, you know, sense of humor. And as you mentioned early on, or I mentioned early on at the beginning of this podcast, you said, you know, religion is serious and sublime. It's religious writing should reflect that. I mean, all too often we get too many deep thinking theologians that put too much thought in it and make it really kind of dull. So I really appreciate the approach that you bring to it. I do have to ask you about one of your previous books though, because it is somewhat of a controversial book. It was In Defense of Hypocrisy. I think what was the In Defense of Hypocrisy was the title of the book. It says Picking Sides in the War on Virtue. Just give us a real quick lowdown on that. What side on the War of Virtue did you pick?
Virtues? No. You know, the In Defense of Hypocrisy was just looking at what we're arguing about when we're arguing about hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that it's like a gigantic distraction. When hypocrisy is all about trying to paint your enemy as a nefarious character, and then he has to defend himself, and then that basically just shuts down debate. And if that's what you want to do, then great. But if a lot of us don't think that that's the best approach.
I can understand that. I've often thought too that if you know hypocrisy has a certain virtue to it, and that, you know, if you got to have standards in order to have hypocrisy, so it's at least you have some standards you're trying to strive for. Cool. Hey, I got one last question before we leave you off here. And I mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to come back to it. Is Research on Religion going to get a regular post on Real Clear Religion every Monday morning?
You know, I could be talked into it at some point.
Okay, because, you know, I'm not just some cranky old grandmother blogging in my pajamas from Cedro Woolley. I'm a cranky old man blogging from my den in Duval, Washington. So, yeah, really like to, if you could do that, that would be great for us. And next time I'm up in the Linden, I'll buy the pitchers of beer. How's that sound?
We'll talk off the air.
All right. Hey, very good. So, Jeremy, I want to thank you very much for being with us here today on the show, and also for doing what you're doing at Real Clear Religion, because it is a great site that I've been going to and using quite frequently and pulling stuff off for ideas for my own research, and as well as for shows on stuff on this as well. So, Jeremy, thanks a lot for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.